This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Dree.
Lindsay Clancy, lots to go through here. Conspiracy and confusion. That's what I want to address. Literally, I'm going through the comments of you guys over the last several weeks directly from our YouTube. I've copied many of them into my teleprompter and document here that we're going to work through. And we're going to go through various theories, various observations, misunderstandings, confusion, because there's a lot of it here in this case, where at the end of the day, I don't care what you land on, whether you think and believe that Lindsay Clancy was someone who did this and was completely understanding of what she was doing, or if you think she was psychotic. What I do care about is that you're getting there based on fact and based on truth, and not based on conspiracy or just flat out confusion, because there's so much out there with it. Lindsay Clancy admits she killed her three children. That's one fact both sides of this trial agree on. And somehow it's the fact getting buried under everything else. Patrick did it. The knife was set down by a left-handed man. She fled the country. He fled the country. I mean, these things just they're not based on reality. There's a rope on the bedroom door. She never heard a voice until her lawyer needed one. Again, those things I just stated, these are things that are out there in the ether being presented as fact. Some have nuggets of fact attached to them. Some are not at all. Every one of those claims is circulating right now, and every one of them has an answer on the trial record. This is, like I said, Lindsay Clancy, conspiracy and confusion. We're pulling some of the comments straight from this channel, the ones with the most traction and the most confidence, and we're checking each claim against what was actually said under oath in Plymouth Superior Court. What you decide about Lindsay Clancy is yours. Guilt, insane, failed by doctors, all three. Reasonable people are landing in very different places. Robin Dreek, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, is with me as always to help us do just this. I'm just going to jump into one here. I'm going to read it verbatim, and then we can kind of to parse through some of the claims being made.
Before you do, quick, I want to first, let's before we start diving in the first one, let's give some, again, we've said this throughout this case, I want to give everyone a methodology to think about these things.
Okay.
We have an amazing audience, and I've really come to respect the critical thinking in our audience. So I want to remind everyone, when you see or get information, what my process is and what a critical thinking process, especially in this world of true crime, that is, one, if you come up with an idea or theory, the number one thing I think you should start trying to do is find facts and data to disprove it. Secondly, if you hear a competing fact or theory that you don't agree with, find facts and data that would prove it. This keeps your brain constantly in motion, trying to find real facts and data free of confirmation bias. And then, if you keep landing on your theory and it's going very well and you have facts and data and you can't disprove it and you're seeing other data, look for opportunities to correct yourself and be wrong along the path. Like I told Jennifer yesterday on the show, I said, my number one goal amongst many goals is I get excited when I am proving myself wrong and I evolve my opinion of things, because that proves to me I'm critical thinking. So I just want everyone to remain critical thinking. If you hear something, don't dismiss it. Don't celebrate it. Let's investigate it. So with that, Tony, sorry. Let's go.
No, I agree. That's a great way of looking at it. Challenge your beliefs. Try and look at it from the angle of you possibly being wrong, because believe it or not, we can be wrong.
Then the last question you ask yourself, what would it take for me to change my mind? And before you even go any further, write it down. It's like, I have on this case, I have a list of things it would take for me to change my mind. It's very articulate. That way, if you start seeing them, in your, if you don't have them written down, you can dismiss them. Well, I still think this. No, no, no. You actually set a criteria for yourself. Let's analyze that criteria. So with that.
All right. We're going to try and get through as many of these as we can. We're going to start with the conspiracy confusion and the did she do it area, basically, because, again, somehow this is up for litigation on the internet, not in the actual trial. This is not a whodunit case at all. But some are treating it that way. So let's start with this. This is the comment. Quote, there is blood outside the window like she's trying to escape. And apparently there's a rope around the bedroom door. How do you explain that? If she cut her wrists and was trying to commit S, why would you need a rope then? I don't think she was trying to commit S. I think she was trying to get rope off her hand that he did and was trying to frame her for all the murders so he could be with his mistress. These are the comments that make my head want to explode. Because, but I want to tackle them because people read these who don't know anything about the case and go, there's a mistress, there's a rope. No, there's actually none of those things. None of those things are part of this case. Let's just start. Blood outside the window like she's trying to escape. It came from her going out the window. The state police analyst Sherry Crook testified the stains on the sill and shingles were transfer stains. Contact with something bloody. Both sides agree. She went out of there herself. The only fight in court was whether she jumped or slid down. There's no rope. There's just no rope. That's not... not in the testimony, not in the evidence. It's not, there's no rope. Well, so if you're hearing anything about a rope, just know that that's completely made up.
Yeah, I haven't heard anything about a rope either. I have watched every minute of the testimony throughout this entire case. And so there's a few things here. So again, let's investigate it. Let's try to prove this right. And so the things that are don't allow us to prove it right is one, there's no statement, there's no facts and data in there that are accurate. So we can't utilize any of that. And what here's what I'm looking for accuracy. I'm looking for testimony in this case because we are, and a lot of times we're covering cases that haven't been to trial yet. And a lot of times you're covering cases that have already been to trial. So we can use those facts and data and other things that have been leaked out in the internet that we can actually verify through multiple sources. That's what we want to do. And not just hearsay, what firsthand accounts. And so in this case, haven't heard of the rope. So I don't even know where that came from, but let's look at the S attempt here. Mm-hmm. We have two areas to look at on this, and one of them profound and the other one massively profound to say that this was indeed a very, very serious S attempt. And that is, one, the medical examiners of her, you know, the forensic examiners of her. The injury she had was extremely congruent, extremely from wrists to neck to impact of all the internal damage of ribs, bones, organs, which paralyzed her, does not happen from sliding down the side of a building. It's only from head first into ground. That was the testimony of the medical people, strict medical people. And that's profound to me. Even more profound, though, is every single mental health provider in this entire sequence, both for the prosecution and defense, both sides, severe S ideology, mm-hmm. and severe attempts, one actually acted out on, and so severe that even the prosecution's forensic psychologist that's actually still on the stand as of this recording now being cross-examined by Reddington, he actually testified yesterday about how severe it is that he's very rarely seen cases where she's on one-on-one supervision for 3 years after the event. That's how severe that is. So, sliding down the side, escape, someone else doing it, not in there. I won't even give this a 0.1% probability. There's not, both on the pure physical medical side and the mental health side, there's not one person testifying, and there's not one bit of evidence that it's anything but exactly that.
What do you make of so many people going, I don't believe it was a true S attempt. I don't believe she was S idol, all of that. It's like she's telling everyone she is. She's journaling about it. you know, but somehow the conspiracy is that Patrick was setting this all up and telling people that these are private conversations with clinicians where she's saying this before all of this happened. Patrick wasn't involved in those conversations. So for that conspiracy to work, would Patrick sit like paying off the clinicians to say, I mean, I just don't get it when the actual person in question has said on the record 40 different ways what half of the conspiracy theorists are saying is not true. Like, the person is saying it over and over and over and over. I don't know. I mean, there's cases where it's like it's gray area, like maybe they said it, maybe they didn't. That's not this at all.
There's never a. I never give broad sweeps. Look, I use that word never, which means extreme, right?
But yeah.
I tend to not give broad sweeps of everyone in a category. But here's one thing I see for I think a large swath of people that have this theory of it's not her that did this, and that is she's very compelling. So if you are on the side where you don't view her as this evil demon monster, but your mind remained open at the very beginning, and you saw her completely collapse non-verbally and verbally into herself, you hear the story of her background, her arc that has been described about her and her as a mother and as a wife and as a daughter from absolutely everyone that testified, both from the prosecution and the defense side. She's a compelling figure. And she's a figure, as Bob Mata said, our great attorney, on one of those days, the second day, he just wanted to give her a hug. So in the words of other people, you wanted to give a monster a hug? Well, yeah, for some people, she's an extremely compelling person that you can't believe would do something like that. So it must be someone else, and we will find the data to support our observations. And so hence, we're going to do what we do as human beings. We're going to see patterns where patterns do not exist. We're going to have we've come up with our conclusion. It must not be her. So now we're going to collect our confirmation bias data to support that and find a pattern that's not there. That is what happens in these cases. And that's why if we listen to all the testimony, and I thought the doctor on the stand, yes, I can't remember, I can't pronounce his name, the final witness that the defense has put up, I mean, the prosecution has put up for the rebuttal, you know, he gave two practical theories on this one. One, it was either a postpartum psychotic break, as the defense is claiming, or it was a severe S attempt with S ideology and the filicide. Well, what kind of filicide is it? Humanitarian filicide, where she thought the children would be better off dead than without her on this planet. You know, so he came up with two theories on that. So that's what you're left to entertain after yesterday's. But again, it's she's a compelling fit because again, what's that explanation give? Both those explanations give. It wasn't her in her right mind, and that's what that's why the defense is saying what it is. She in her right mind as a human being is incapable of doing these things. And I think the people that are coming up with these theories, it's Patrick, are in the same place. They just don't understand why they're at that place.
Yeah, I think you make a lot of really good points there. Specifically talking about how our minds, this has been most fascinating to me in some of our conversations with Siobhan, of just how we're getting here and finding patterns where patterns don't exist, basically to confirm
the outcome we want.
The condition that we are most comfortable with.
Right.
That's, you know, what version of this story are we going to be able to digest? And it doesn't necessarily at all come down to what was reality here, what happened in Lindsay Clancy's mind. It's what are we okay with on the outside over here, which has nothing to do with the case, of saying that this exists in our world. And that's a very, because it's such an extreme, such a horrific thing. I think a lot of people are having a really hard time dealing with reality on reality's terms, basically.
It is. I mean, yeah. Our discussion yesterday was the same thing, even after after being on air, you know, with Jennifer. It's like, this is a hard thing. It's a very hard thing pragmatically and objectively. And that's why we really honor the jurists in here that have the hardest job out of everyone right now, is they have to sit here and hold two things truth at the same time. The truth of the horror that this mother brutally murdered her kids, and what kind of human being can do that? At the same time, they got to try to hold in the other hand the fact that it wasn't her in her right mind if they're going to go with what the defense is saying. So it's a very, very hard thing to not want. As human beings, we want justice. We want retribution. We want punishment to be doled out from those people that do horrendous things. But our criminal justice system was set up for just these extremely, extremely rare situations where we're going to bring in some more harder science when we need to do it, to take a closer look. And ultimately, what you and I think or what everyone in the public thinks today doesn't matter because we're not on the jury. If it ever gets retried, if she's found guilty and they all the different rebuttals they could do and retrials, you know, we know you might be on that trial. But as of right now, it's in the hands of them. And I think, as we said yesterday, watching the testimony, you know, that the prosecution, I thought, did an okay job as of right now. I think they started hitting more of a stride towards the end with some of the people they brought on board until those people fumbled by calling, invoking religion as they shouldn't have done. But I'll tell you what, Reddington has thrown it all on the table. You know, if they don't side with the defense, it's not because of effort. It's not because of great testimony. It's not because of great cross. And you have to really you have to respect the process.
Yeah. No, I agree. There's a lot of questions here. Let's get into some more of these that have come down on the did she do it again? Not what this case is litigating, but the internet is. I'm just going to read a couple of these that all kind of pertain to the same area. Have you watched the trial at all? Patrick did this. Y'all are going to regret this in the end. The evidence is atrocious. There really isn't any evidence pointing at him. Duxbury police and MSP have destroyed this case. Typical of Massachusetts. When you don't have the evidence for the theory you're going down, you're going to blame then the institutions that failed to gather it for you, I guess, by that logic. Now, look, I'm not a big fan of a lot of Massachusetts law enforcement. I think they've proven themselves quite incompetent in many cases. This case, I don't really have much of an issue with them at all. And but, you know, there's plenty of cases where there has been questions. I don't know enough to speak about this specific department, but that's an interesting way of looking at this one.
Well, it's also not much to investigate. She did it. She admitted she did it, and so you're just collecting data in a very small location, digitally, forensically. I mean, it's not like, and full access. No one was denying anything.
Well, when someone comes up and says that the evidence is atrocious towards Patrick,
what
they're not basing that on evidence. I mean, there's no evidence in this trial about that.
And so here's what you can really then take a look at. So if you think there's more there, and I know Bob Mott has said this, Eric Faddis has said this, we've all said this on our show, and that is you can only go and base what you have on the facts and data collected. And when you have a 50-year defense attorney who is world-renowned for investigating these things and trying these types of things as Kevin Reddington is, if there was a way, I mean, you saw, I think everyone could agree he is very, very passionate and compassionate for his defendee, for Lindsay. There's no doubt about it. If there is a way, and Bob said this too, if there is a way for him to pin this on someone else, he would have found it. There's just because we don't like his affect, just because people think he moved on too fast to marry someone else and fall in love again, or whatever he calls it. Again, this is what's hard for us. We each individually have our own context because we place ourselves in their shoes, not as them, but as us.
Yeah.
What you would do in that situation might be extremely and is extremely different than what they would do in that situation, because here's why. You grew up in a different place. You went to different education. Your reasons for falling in love with someone are different. Your definition of love is something different. Everything you need going through, I mean, how many of you, of us watching have lost three children to a brutal murder by your wife? And what does that feel like? What do you need to recover from that? What kind of therapy have you been through or not been through? See, all these facts and data give us each our individual context of what is. And so, again, it comes down to who are you to judge the right and wrong of someone else's actions, especially if it's not illegal. But I know they're claiming it's illegal that he did it. But where? There's just – now, granted, I'll live in the world of maybe on absolutely everything. And if someone can – provide data, facts, and analysis that says there's a glimmer of something there that is actually not conjecture. That's not some theory to prove your point. It's just not there.
I don't he moved on to, like, there's a comment there we just saw. The speed at which Patrick met his wife and remarried does make me question her motives. It was 3 years he waited to get married. That's not a short period of time. That's three years.
You know what's
years.
Interesting about that, too? I'll tell you, I'm curious about it because it's a painful thing to move on from, and it's an awful. So I'm less curious about Patrick, believe it or not, on this. I'm curious about what must be going through his mind, because when you get in the world of behavioral analysis, I'm compelled to try to understand everyone that's touching this, that touches everything. That's why I'm always looking at degrees of separation, the people in your lives, the relationships, the communication, all of it. And with Patrick, the one thing that I'm really, really curious about is, yes, him, but I'm really curious about the amazing, and I only say amazing because I don't know her. I can only imagine the amazing woman it must be to subject herself to this, knowing what he's been through, knowing that he didn't fall out of love with her, but, you know, from what we've seen, we remember. So what I mean, I'm really curious. I mean, it takes a really special person to be able to do that and go through this scrutiny. So I'm a glass half full until I see something. Otherwise, I see a lot of really in this whole circle of people surrounding Lindsay. I see nothing but really caring, empathetic people. No. And I haven't seen a wobble here anywhere. Matter of fact, that's the most unusual thing to me in this entire case. There's no wobble. I haven't seen a wobble yet from anyone.
That's the most frustrating part about this case is like, we see wobbles in all sorts of cases all the time, and nobody sees them. And this one doesn't have any, but yet everyone sees one, and we're like, no, there's no wobble. It's like,
I find this the other day too. It's like, how do I see things? So my 22 plus years with the FBI on my behavior team, running my behavior team, when we did a behavioral consult on a case, we are assessing the motivations, actions, and deeds of an individual, management, all these people in the circle that was surrounding this case. And what we would do is we would behaviorally observe that person over their life arc. That's where I come up with this. I mean, it wasn't just me randomly coming up with this. I mean, this was my process for how I understood people, their motivations, their likes, their wants, their interests, their priorities in life, the pain points, all those things in someone's life to understand what makes them make the decisions they do from their best interest. And then what we had is we had our operational forensic psychologist sitting with us on our team as I'm making my behavioral observations. They're then doing what we're seeing in the trial here. They're actually weighing in forensically, psychologically, science-wise to say if that makes sense or not makes sense. And so I'm very practiced at seeing wobbles, if they're real, imagine what's and linking the two together. I mean, it's a lot of reps of doing this. And I'm telling you, I hate using these I statements, but for me, I have not seen a wobble in any of these circles yet, anywhere near, as a matter of fact, not even near, I haven't even seen one, but anywhere near any other case we've ever covered, even with people that were innocent. No, I haven't seen it.
Yeah, I agree. Your thoughts in the comment section, Substack and YouTube. Links are in the description. We'll continue it there. We're going to continue on to our next section here about Lindsay Clancy. That was about the fight on the internet over did she do it. Now let's go over to another portion of the arguments in Lindsay Clancy, confusion and conspiracy. We're going to be talking about another element of this specifically, which is, I'm trying to get my notes pulled over here as we,
let me pull them up. I got them.
And then it moved on me right around here. Okay. The psychosis fight. That's what we're looking at here. So let's dive into that. Okay. A lot of people speaking about it and speaking, and I think it's important when you're reading comments, just because someone says they have some sort of standing or some sort of education or some sort of backing in what they're talking about doesn't mean they actually do. And there's a lot of people grandstanding right now. And this one kind of stood out to me because it's funny what they claim to be in control of and what they claim to be an expert of pretty much falls apart within their first sentence. Okay, here we go. This is two posts here that were on our YouTube. It says, study psychosis. Psychosis absolutely does not surface 1 second and subsurface the next second like they're implying. Psychotics do not know the difference between reality and what is not real. So they're already conflating two different things right there. There's psychosis and psychopathy. Psychotic is not a person suffering from psychosis. So I'll throw it back into your court. How about you study it, considering you're fucking it up within the first sentence of what you're trying to argue? Why would she ask if she had a lawyer as soon as she wakes up from a coma? A true psychotic would not consider that they did something wrong because their reality conduced that they do what they did. They kind of got the Brian Koberger, let's go to the thesaurus and throw words into sentence thing going on there. You're just wrong. You're just wrong. That's all. You're just wrong on your use of the words and your assumption of what those things mean. I got nothing more for you. You're simply wrong. And then they double down in another post. I actually studied psychology at a university level. Well, I feel bad for that university. A person with psychosis doesn't rationalize regarding their hallucinary perceptions. What is this Koberger? Because there's a lot of like, let's get words in here. The person actually believes that what he hears or sees is real. Nobody can say a voice made me do it. Why didn't she listen to the real voices of the people that surrounded her continuously providing help and support? Now her biased psychologist, which was hired by Reddington, said that she didn't tell any other therapist that she heard voices telling her to harm the children except for him, and that after she murdered the children, she didn't once hear them again. Sentences, sentence structure. Suddenly, the supposed psychosis she only reported after she committed the murders is gone. How convenient. How convenient. Okay. Doctor?
It's interesting how, there's the way these things like this get a lot of play with people is because there's a few fact truths in there that are sprinkled in that say, oh, it must be, I recognize that must be true.
Yeah.
But it's sprinkled in a lot of tons of conjecture, tons of really wrong statements, inaccurate statements. And so when you put that all together in a word salad like that, it can sound authoritative. And when people like to try to be in, one of the Robert Cialdini's rules of influence is authority. And so if someone kind of decide, well, I have a degree in this and degree in this, I have authority, kind of like what they're doing in the testimony right now. All right, so let's hear about your authority. Let's back it up with something. And so there's nothing here on that one. It's a word salad all over the place. Now, and some of the things they were also saying, like, when you're a psychotic break, you don't rationalize your behavior. She didn't. She just described what was happening. Command hallucinations are exactly that. They're command hallucinations. Matter of fact, according to Resnick, it wasn't just a command hallucination. It was command action as well, unable to control the voice. Now, there's a few fair points. That's why I said there's a few fair points in there. So some of the psychologists that are testified and mental health professionals also said that it was unusual for one massive episode like this to last for 22 minutes, as they said yesterday. But again, that guy is doing what right now? He's under cross-examination by Reddington. So he's kind of debunking his authority on that one. So that's what we do. Keep an open mind and keep it all in, and then it's never just one thing you're looking at. You're looking at totality of everything. And if this is one wobble for you, okay, like I'm telling you, yesterday was a little bit of a wobble for me. I thought he had some great testimony until he brought up religion, and he didn't lose it for me, but he lost it for the jury on that and a lot of people because it was completely inappropriate, got reprimanded for it, almost caused a mistrial on it. But there's a lot of data in there to go through. And again, when you have a wobble, we explore it a little bit deeper, but that's what Reddington's doing now. But that's how we interrogate information and keep in the world of maybe until the jury decides. But yeah, most of what was said in there, it's a lot of inaccuracies, tons of inaccuracies, but with a few facts sprinkled in there that makes it sound.
And that's how this case goes from like educated discussion to I heard ... and then people heard that.
I'm going to give thanks, though. I will give thanks. You know, as I said to Jen yesterday on the show, and I say to her audience that is, a lot of these people aren't our regular audience, but hey, I thank you. Thank you for making me think really, really hard on this case, because we explore every avenue and it makes me really think hard. I do a ton more research than I typically do. But you make me think. But so that's why interrogate the information. I'll try to prove you right. But you know what? Not even close.
Yeah. I mean, just to answer some of the points about psychosis not surfacing the way it did, every expert who addressed this says it does. They're misconstruing psychopathy and psychosis, two very different things. I won't give you a full lesson. You can find it. We did a great segment with Siobhan about it the other day.
Yeah, absolutely.
She asked for a lawyer waking up from a coma. True. Dr. Brias testified that she did, that she felt horrified. I would too. I mean, if you're coming out of that psychosis and realizing, oh my God, what the hell did I do? You would be horrified. You might be wanting to ask for an attorney because there's no way of explaining your way out of that. And you're trying to figure out what the fuck just happened to me. So that seems like a reasonable request. She didn't tell any other therapist except him. It's half right. Zeisel conceded her treatment records from September 22 to January 23. Don't document a voice, but after the killing, she described it to Patrick on February 6th, and Patrick testified to it, to Chaplain Kavanaugh, to Dr. Resnick, and to Dr. Mack, the prosecution's own rebuttal witness. Never heard them again. How convenient. Well, Zeisel did testify under cross that she hasn't heard voices since 23. She's also been under continuous psychiatric treatment and medication in Tewksbury since May of 23. Both sides have that fact. They read it a little bit differently. There you go.
So there's a few things in there. So asking for a lawyer right after. Here's what I'm going to do. That's a wobble to me. That was interesting. It's like, all right. So that, again, that's why I entertain it. It's like, all right, what kind of situation would make me want to do that? Would make her want to do that? How common is that? So that's where when I hear something like that, I dive into research. All right, how many people coming out of a situation like this that they've done a horrendous act or been accused of a horrendous act, how often do they make this as one of their first statements, one of their first concerns? And then I look at the research. Mm-hmm. I look at my own impressions. I look at research. And I say, it's actually a little more common than you thought it was, even though it stands out here because it's the first time you've ever seen it. Doesn't mean it's the first time it's ever been done. So I look at research. I look at data. I look at context, and so that's how I deal with that one. But I entertain it because you're right. I agree. When I heard that, I said, "Boy, that's a little interesting, isn't it?" But in the totality of everything that's going on, I say it's not a wobble, but definitely gave me an initial one. And as for it's interesting, and I agree. I want to caveat everything as we do every day. Not a mental health professional, not a licensed clinician or anything like that. Not pretending to be an expert in this area. Just reflecting back the things I've heard in testimony through my own experiences and things like that. I have found the whole discussion on the psychotic break of her and the postpartum psychosis very interesting as well, because there's a lot of nuances to it. It's rare, it's unusual, and because it's so rare and unusual, it's hard to study over long periods of time. But here's something interesting I found that no one's talked about yet when it comes to human behavior. A lot of the things that have been testified to, and this is based on a testify, but they haven't brought up afterward, is that the amount of stress that she was under, the feeling she had because of being overwhelmed as a mother, and the lack of sleep, not being able to get exercise, her diet, all these things, the medications that were off and on, all the things. Every single medical professional has talked about all those stressors escalating, and all those escalations were getting worse and worse and worse, that eventually led to what some of the experts, especially on defense side, were saying was the psychotic break, which happened for about 18 to 22 minutes. Again, I'm guessing at that, but that's roughly what they said during the testimony. So, and then everyone's saying, well, how come it's that one-time thing? Well, let's look at this. Remember, we just outlined, and all the medical professionals outlined, all the events that were happening in her life that led to the psychotic break, according to defense. So what happened after the psychotic break? All those stressors left. So why would she still have a psychotic break if all those things fed into the psychotic break? She's in a hospital. Her kids are gone because she killed them. And the medications have shifted. All the things that led to the break had shifted. So I would expect that to shift as well. And remember, from testimony, psychosis ebbs and flows. And this could be my hypothesis as a potentiality, but they didn't cover in testimony, so I don't know as a fact, as the fact that since, I'll ask Siobhan about it, since a lot of those stressors changed, there's a good probability that the reason why we didn't see the psychosis again afterwards is because the things that led to it were no longer there.
It got under control, basically. Yeah. I mean, well, yeah, she was misdiagnosed. She was taking the wrong types of medication because she was prescribed the wrong types of medication for bipolar. It turns out bipolar, misdiagnosed as anxiety, generalized anxiety disorder, and depression. Those meds, you take those, which there's plenty of, and she certainly had a lot of them. You take those and your true underlying condition is bipolar, they're going to do the opposite. And one of the side effects happens to be psychosis. It's pretty clear cut. It's pretty clear cut how we got here. You manage it correctly, it can go away. People can live with bipolar and live happy, productive lives when managed correctly. But obviously all the damage was done here. She did what she did. But yes, she may be now in a better state of control. But of course it went away. It's finally being managed correctly because it took a bomb going off for someone to finally go, oh, maybe it's this.
All the stresses it had caused, it had changed.
Yeah. Yeah,
especially the lack of sleep. You know, Siobhan highlighted it, and other professionals during the testimony have highlighted that lack of sleep was the kerosene that kept fueling the fire from you know, postpartum depression to suicide, well, SIDization, and then from bipolar to bipolar two. I mean, hell, I'm learning about bipolar and bipolar two differences. I mean, I'm learning so much in this case. I mean, that, you know, again, you know, for the horrendousness of what we're witnessing and going through, you know, the education we're all getting on this and how important mental health is and mental health for women, especially that are dealing with postpartum issues, is tremendous. And the lack of resources, or I want to say some places I'm sure are very good, but we're seeing the highlighted the places that are absolutely atrocious and have failed so miserably.
This is about average, if you will, and that's not good. Yeah, okay. This is another string of comments that we've been seeing kind of coming in. I'm just going to read a bunch of them off and we'll kind of go through the mistruths in them. She was non-compliant taking the medication, meaning most of the medication she got off just as soon as she started. She was building an alibi. I understand it's incomprehensible that a human being, especially a nurse mother, be that insidious, but it happens and there are people out there just like it. Lindsay knew she was doing wrong. A male entity did not possess her and make her do everything. No one's saying she was possessed. She sent her husband away. She searched various things, including Andrea Yates, getting information she needed, and an alibi. She is a sociopath. Another one, if one thinks critically, yes, the psychosis theory is disputable, called crafting an alibi, called having a cluster B personality disorder. It's emotional to claim it's indisputably temporary psychosis. And another one, believing that she searched Andrea Yates. No such search appears in any testimony of her searching Andrea Yates. Her former colleague, Margaret Hemp, testified that when she told Lindsay about the Yates case in Lindsay's first year on the unit, Lindsay had never heard of it and cried, asking how a mother could do that to her children. What she did actually search was how can you treat a sociopath on January 20th, which prosecutors highlight, and symptoms of postpartum psychosis, hallucinations on January 19th, and intrusive on January 20th, which the defense highlights. Same phone, both sides. Non-compliant, got off the medication as soon as it started. Partly true and contested. Jolotta testified Lindsay asked to change meds nearly daily and at one point wanted to stop entirely. The defense's answer is that the drugs were making her worse. And when an infant's hospital itself recommended tapering a Seroquel. And so, there was 30 different prescriptions, 13 different meds, 30 in total different dosages of those 13 that were doled out on and off, which you just shouldn't be doing. And this is where the provider question comes in.
Because non-compliant is ridiculous.
Non-compliant is not the right word here. And also toxicity is not the right word either, because it seems it's either she didn't take them at all or they weren't to toxic levels.
And part of the reasons for it also was not just the negative effect it was having on her, but also she she was trying to breastfeed and she didn't want to affect the baby. So think about this. She was not wanting to take the drugs. First of all, she feared getting addicted. So she was definitely feared of her health for being addicted to these drugs.
The second they affected her sleep. That's the big thing with these drugs, is which was the fear of not being able to sleep. Yes.
And also it was affecting her being able to breastfeed, which she wanted to take care of her newborn.
Oh, Robin, remember, she hates her children and is somehow conspiring to let Patrick.
See that? That's why the only explanation, if you're going to this, is what the doctors were saying. And then also, I'm with you to the creating an alibi. So if she was creating an alibi here, here's a guarantee, it wouldn't be the first time in her life she's creating secret life and trying to create an explanation, an alibi, lying, deception, all those things create wobbles in people's lives. This wouldn't be her first rodeo doing something like that. There'd be other leakage that would have come out in the investigation. There'd be leakage from her friends, families, and colleagues. And Reddington, I guaranteed, would have saw that and done something about it and investigated someone else or something else. As well as the prosecution. Yeah. not even Reddington. Think about this. If the prosecution had any inkling of an alibi being tried to be crafted by her, it would have been presented.
Yeah.
Guaranteed.
The other allegation that she's a cluster B. Again, look, we've seen that in plenty of cases. She's been reviewed by many experts now, and cluster B sociopath ain't the diagnosis. Nope. It's a bipolar too. If you're armchair diagnosing, there's some elements that can look kind of like that. There is. I get how there can be confusion on that, without a doubt. But the actual doctors who have taken the time to look at her did not come back with that conclusion. Yep. So there
is. And a lot of doctors over a large period of time before the event, right after the event, and 3 years after the event. So a lot have looked at her entire span of time, and that one never came up.
Yeah. So that's that. Let's go and continue the conversation. The Lindsay Clancy conspiracy and confusion episode, as we try to break through so many of the comments that are out there about this case, where it is, where it's going, what's fact, what's fiction. Remember the old show? Remember Fact or Fiction? That was like, it was on like Sunday nights or something.
Right.
It was like truth, fact, truth and the guy's advice. Walking through fog, and it was like stories that you had to determine if they were real or not. It was like Unsolved Mysteries era back, like early 90s or so. It's kind of what it reminds me. We just need a fog machine. That would be great. Okay, the last five here aren't about the night of January 24th. They're about everything around it, what Patrick did before and after, who actually qualified to call her a psychopath, and what the verdict means either way. This is where the most confident comments have the least record behind them, as we're going to go through. And I certainly welcome yours and your thoughts in the comments section as we try to break some of these down. Let's start here. You don't get, or you don't, people's writing, you don't get meat and marry in one day. He didn't, so I guess calm down. Many people confirm that he went to New You 4 months after the children were buried. You often do not have the facts. I guess he went to New You. Shit, I was saying York all this time. The four-month claim is true. Public records show Patrick moved to Manhattan in May 23 and took a job at Microsoft. Yes, and here's what the facts say. He took a job at Microsoft, and 3 years later, he got married.
Isn't it amazing? You move to a city after a horrendous event to get away from that horrendous event, and you might meet someone in that city.
You meet somebody? Oh my! This is what I don't understand about people on this whole damn thing. So he takes a new job. He's trying to restart his life after taking basically a finding himself trip overseas. It was like, he went on a vacation, like he's on like some sort of like Sandals Beach or something. He was staying in hostels, so he didn't have to see families and children. And basically, I think, I don't know, if it were me, I'd be debating of whether or not I'm coming back alive.
Let's thought experiment this one.
Yeah.
I like experimenting with this one. So let's for the sake of this say that, all right, we think Patrick actually did this intentionally. and that he's actually behind this in some way, or he actually did something because he actually had the mistress on the side, so he's actually the culprit behind her. All right, so let's say that's actually true for the sake of this thought experiment. If that was true, what would be the most advantageous testimony he could provide? Would it be the testimony that might actually at some point allow his former wife out after her therapy, potentially? Or would he paint her as a picture of someone who is a horrible mother with psychotic breaks, not with psychotic breaks all the time, that's pre-planned, she's horrendous, I did everything I could get away from her, I couldn't do it. In other words, how would he paint her? Would he paint her as a monster, or would he paint her in a picture of someone who actually needs help and be congruent with everyone else?
That's an interesting take, Robin. That kind of debunks it all right
what
there.
What serves him? So if he did this action for himself, that means all actions would be self-serving.
Yeah.
So if that is the case, how is it self-serving, the testimony he gave on her behalf? It's not.
It's not.
It's her serving, not him self-serving. Yeah. So...
done. Let's go back to the relationship for a second. I don't know when they first started dating. Yes, he moved to New York 4 months later to start a new job. That is fact. And he got married 3 years later. What exactly do people want him to have done? What would have been okay by the TikTokers for him to, if he meets? Let's just say, I don't know when he met the new wife, but let's just say 4 months in, 5 months in, a year in, whatever. He's at his new job in a new city, trying to start a new life, mourn the loss, and go through an incredible amount of grief that most of us, thank God, will never have to contemplate ever feeling. When is it okay for him to, if he meets someone, to let them into his life, and then maybe it does turn romantic at some point? Should he just say, no, I'm sorry, TikTokers say this is too soon. I'm desperately, really... want some sort of connection with a human being as I'm going through this, but TikTok says it's too much. I mean, what the?
So I'm gonna have to put on a big conjecture hat on this one, because we weren't in the courtroom, but I've seen some accounts of the 911 call recently today of people that were in the courtroom actually listened and actually heard the 911 call. And I'm gonna play that, and I'm gonna bring this in a second, because to answer the question, what would it take for someone to accept that from him remarrying or finding someone in his life again? For those people, from what you have seen from him now, I don't think it would be anything, because they think he's guilty no matter what. So they're always going to have data and confirmation bias for any action he takes, which is going to be against Patrick. So there's nothing that he could do, or any time period, or anything like that. Because if you compare and contrast the people in the courtroom and how they testified, they were looking for something more from the father that lost his children and whose wife is on trial. They're looking for an emotional difference in what they saw. Now, here's my theory and conjecture on this. From what I understand, the reaction in the courtroom and the jury was to the playing of the 911 call of the blood-curdling, never heard before screams emanating from him from seeing and witnessing what he witnessed that day. That's the compelling figure and emotion they're expecting on the bench, in the witness box, that they didn't see. I would theorize if more people had heard that, this theory wouldn't be the same.
Yeah.
Because they actually saw the raw emotion. I think, as Siobhan said on our show when we talked about this and talked about Patrick, when people go through, I mean, seriously, think about this. Could you fully embrace that moment for the rest of your life? Are you going to go through therapy, or even if not in therapy, try to compartmentalize that and shut it out, because the pain, I can't even fathom. I can't even, you know, my son's about to be deployed, and even the thought of what we've had to go through with insurance, if something happens, I mean, it's devastating, the mere thought of it. And three, one day your baby's, and your wife lost her shit. The amount of compartmentalization of the emotion you had that day to be able to function today and still live I can't even imagine the compartmentalization he's got to go through. So what everyone saw was not the emotion he felt that day. everyone saw is emotion he has to try to feel now to move forward. And so you are blaming him for trying to survive. I don't think that's very just.
I don't either. I really wonder if that 911 call had been played for the world to hear, if we would be having this conversation about Patrick.
Just I heard of it.
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Is that part of the absence? You know, because that's what people like to do, Robin. They like to fill in the blanks when they don't have the information with whatever conjecture they, you know, fits their narrative. And that's a big blank for a lot of people. And a lot of people have been taking the transcript basically of the call. We have that, but we don't have the emotion behind it. And a lot of people are taking some of the words that are said in that phone call and reading them very differently. When it comes to the line about the kids, she killed, and I apologize if I'm misinterpreting where the word F comes right in here.
Yep.
She killed the effing kids or something of that nature. Any way you put the F in there, to me, it reads about the same. And a lot of people are going, he's referring to the kids with the word effing. I wouldn't refer to my kids with the word effing in there. If I had been in that situation and my ex had done that, I probably would. Not because I'm speaking disparaging about the children, but because I'm in shock. Because what she had threatened to do, what she had talked about having weird ideations about doing for months on end, but never had a plan to do, actually was carried out. And I just got home and it was a good day. What the F just happened here? She killed the effing kids.
There'd be wobbles reported about him from friends, family, in-laws.
I just don't see how that's a weird statement on the part. I mean, it tracks to me.
Yeah, especially if you have it the context as was being described by others. It wasn't just a placid, well, you know, she killed the effing kids.
No,
it was emotional destruction happening in that moment.
Yeah.
And that's what, I mean, because again, do your thought experiment, and you can't because it's that's gruesome. Three babies and your wife.
Yeah. Expletives would be flying in places where they don't make sense.
This is not a performative emotion. I mean, when you think about that, you just like, you can become speechless, shockless. I mean, you're trying to express. I mean,
I might just be sitting in the corner saying F over and over. You know, I don't know that I would be making much coherent sense.
I'm with you. It's unfathomable. It's completely emotionally unfathomable. So since it's emotionally unfathomable, it's hard to imagine the emotions he would have or anyone would have.
One more.
But here's what I know they weren't. Again, 911 calls are so important. I'm good friends with a few people that actually studied them at the PhD level. And I said it before too. You know, look at 911 calls on any other case we've covered where the perpetrator is actually the one that called the 911 call. Typically, not 100%, but typically 95 to 98% of them, they are more focused on their actions, on what they were doing leading up to that, and being very descriptive. Oh my God, I just got home. I just came back from, I mean, this is hypothetically, if he was potentially not innocent, you know, if he was guilty of this or somehow tied to this. Oh my God, I just got back from picking up our food for dinner for the kids. I left her alone. He'd be describing exactly what was going on rather than the explicative of the shock, extreme shock he was experiencing. So in other words, he was in such shock of what he saw. There's no description he could cognate of anything that's going on except the trauma he's experiencing. People that have pre-planned, that have premeditation, and people that have been involved in some way are explaining their actions in it because, I know it's being recorded. I know they're going to be able to do this. So they got to explain away my actions as my own alibi.
I was at the gym. The door was locked. I broke it down. I don't know how she was stabbed 17 times.
Greenberg, yes, we were thinking of that exactly.
Not saying he did anything. Just saying it's a little weird.
Saying your 911 call really sucked if you're innocent.
You want to hear a weird 911 call and get mad at somebody? Go take a listen to that case. Ellen Greenberg. Have fun. One more. This is another comment, and this is another interesting consensus that is gaining traction online. It stays on Patrick. I'm sorry, Patrick. We're just breaking our way through it. I think Patrick is weak. That is not a crime. If he had been stronger, he would have gotten her the help she needed. He wanted the perfect life to come back and stuck his head in the sand. He will have to live with this and must feel guilt. Peace to all concerned. So many people failed Lindsay, including Patrick. What Patrick did per testimony. Okay, here's what has actually been on the record. He called Jolotta with Lindsay on December 15th, 2022 to say it was her worst day, and she was at Mass General ER that night. On December 30th, he called South Shore Hospital to arrange McLean. She was admitted January 1st and stayed 5 days. He testified he checked in on her every morning. Jolotta testified that she raised a bipolar disorder with a couple, and Patrick said, "My wife is not bipolar." That's on the record. It's fair to weigh. And for whatever, you know, people sometimes don't like accepting hard diagnoses. It is what it is. I would call it human. But I wouldn't call it that he wasn't there for his wife.
Well, it's not reported anywhere. I mean, that's the easiest thing on any of these things. It's easy since we have a trial here. There hasn't been any testimony by prosecution people or defense people, whether medical professionals, friends, family, in-laws. Again, go down the list. There hasn't been one individual that testified that said he didn't do all he could, that he wasn't part of it, that he was unaware of these things, that he was dismissive, that he was a culprit. Yeah. Everyone said, they either said nothing or they said he did everything he could have. I mean, it's...
There's no doctors that said, don't leave her alone. Now, one could make the argument and say, maybe you should have made that call yourself. Maybe you should have erred on the side of caution and said, I'm not leaving you alone. I agree. You know, but
sure,
again,
says that right now to himself every day.
I'm sure every fucking second of the day he says
and
that.
And everyone
to
else
himself.
That knows him. And so think about that too. You think about, you know, let's go back to his affect right now. So not only has to compartmentalize the horror he witnessed that day so he can live on, but the other part of it is he's got to live with that guilt.
Yeah.
And it's unfounded guilt. But it's guilt that every survivor faces. He's got. Can you imagine the survivor guilt he has? Not just of the three kids, but of all this that's coming down on him. That you should have done more for your wife. How do you live with that and not compartmentalize? I don't know. Cowards take the easy way out with S.
Yeah,
I give him a lot of credit for not. It takes a lot of bravery to go on every single day right now facing these nutters out there and having to face not just nutters. You're facing the loss of your three children. You're facing the fact that he's living with survivor guilt and he's asking himself. So for all these people that are pounding on him, you think he's not doing that every day of his life to himself?
It's a good point. You know, we've talked about Lindsay a lot, and I've said many a times, I will be surprised if she's around a year from now, because unless they keep her on S watch pretty tight, which I know they certainly have leading up to this trial to make sure she gets to the trial. But I kind of theorize a little bit like, well, once the trial is done and there's not this incessant need to keep her here for the trial, and sometimes that gets a little more lax, I don't know that she's going to be around. Patrick, though. I don't think I would have made it to the trial. Honest to God, I don't know. I would have had if I had three kids, this happened. I don't know. I would have had the strength to go start a new job in 4 months. I mean, some people can, some people can't. And it's not an indictment on him. Maybe I could if I compartmentalize it. I'd be a very unhealthy person. But if that's what you got to do to live, that's what you got to do to live. I don't know that I could have done it, but I know that I would have made it. The fact that he's alive is kind of amazing.
It is, because here's another thing, you know, when it comes to his testimony and why he testified on behalf of her as well, because, I mean, in my own, you know, placing myself in their own situation, do you think he's blaming her or himself more?
I don't know.
I mean, because if he feels he failed her to recognize these things...
I don't know if there's a more there or if it's just a constant...
All of it. Just all of it.
Dull, horrific pain that will never go away for every day of his life. And then when he logs online right now to do anything, he's seeing his name come up, being connected with doing the most horrific thing that's ever happened to him. Yeah. And that's got to be hell. I mean, it's re-victimizing somebody, and it's really sick. It's sick.
I don't know any other word for it.
I don't even have a word to describe it because it's inhuman. What you're doing to another human being, where there's absolutely zero evidence. As a matter of fact, all the evidence is contrary to everything you're saying out of your mouth, and you're intentionally trying to inflict and incite pain against another human being. I mean, ask yourself.
I think
that's
the disconnect, though, Rob. I don't think people are connecting. Oh, there's a human being at the end of this, because oftentimes
you're purposely inciting pain on them.
But oftentimes, if we're coming across on a screen to someone, we're not living, we're not human. People then feel the ability to say things they wouldn't necessarily say to someone if you're walking down the street. So I think you have that disconnect going on too.
You have all these great ideas, you're not smarter than all the investigators and the attorneys that handled this. I guarantee you're not. You didn't come up with some wild thing that no one thought of and that they've been working on for the last 3 years. You're not that smart. I'm sorry. I'm not that smart. And we've been covering this. No, I don't know anyone that's smart. And it has nothing to do with smarter or intelligent or not. You just don't have the same access to the raw data and information that they do. So shush.
Well, here's a thought, though. And I guess why do some people feel empowered that they do feel like they believe that they have this sort of information? Because in completely unrelated cases, there are times where the person sitting at home does know what the hell's going on better than what an investigation says. But then they're judging all cases by that prism and by that investigation, and every single one is different. It's all confirmation biases all coming through, and then there's a lot of projection going on too in this one, which makes it the lovely cornucopia of chaos that it is.
Yeah, as everyone knows, I read a lot, and there's a great book out there called The Courage to be Disliked. Hmm. And in the book, The Courage to be Disliked, they tackle one of the hardest things each of us has as a human being, and that is the realization that you're just average. You're not special. You don't have a special thought or idea or anything else. You know what? In the span of the people existing on this planet today and throughout the history of our species, sorry to say, you are just average. And to think that you actually came up with some wild-ass theory that makes you special, nah. We're all just average. We're all just doing the best we can, trying to support each other, trying to figure things out, trying to make the world a better place. But in reality, no matter how hard each of us does this, Tony, me, my wife, my amazing kids, who I think are more than average, but you know what? In reality, I think they're above average. They're excellent. But in reality of life and the span of our species, no, we're all just pretty damn average. So get over yourself.
Nobody's special. That's the message today from Rob.
Special today. Sorry. No one's special today.
That's Robin's new book. Nobody's special.
Nobody's special. The follow-up to It's Not All About Me is Nobody's Special.
Can you tell a theme here?
With a foreword by Fred Rogers.
Sorry. I'm so sorry. I don't want to be a Debbie Downer, but you know you're not special.
This is like the most down thing you've ever said.
But it's a reality check. It's true. Really, it's my daily reality, you know. It's a great book, but it's also a great message to remind yourself, don't, and this is the theme of it, don't fall in love with your own voice.
It's true. I had that basically mentally beat into me growing up. I think I spent most of my adult life trying to go, maybe I'm a little special. Maybe I...
Don't tell your mothers. Your mothers say no matter what, you are special.
But I can tell you, my upbringing was the opposite of you're special. It's you're pretty average. There's nothing special.
I think it was Dave McCullough's son, and I can't remember his name. Dave McCullough, the great history writer that wrote the book 1776, Benjamin Franklin. No, not Benjamin Franklin. That was another great author. Truman, John Adams. I mean, great history writer of American history. It was his son that got up at the high school graduation, or it might have been college graduation. No, I think it's high school graduation. And he actually went through the stats of everyone graduating that day, of all the valedictorians across the country, of all the great things all you did. And he said, you know what? As special as everyone's saying you are today, you're all just average.
I love it.
So get a grip on reality, folks, and ask yourself, is what I'm about to say going to help or hinder someone else in their path and their journey? And are you causing pain or comfort in someone else? And do you really need to say that? And are you being a me-former or an informer?
It's a good filter to run anything through before it hits the comments section.
We all try.
So think of that before you drop them in there. Links are in the description. Substack, YouTube, go check them out. Robin's latest book, it's this one right here. It's not all about me. Go check it out. Amazon, leave a review. Until next time, for Robin, for Todd, I'm Tony. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Brewski and the Hidden Killers podcast.